Hello and welcome to Ed Talks, the podcast from King Edward School Birmingham and King Edward's High School for Girls, where I get to talk to old Edwardians from the Boys and Girls School. And I'm really privileged to say this, actually. These are people who haven't just excelled in the careers they've gone into. They've risen to the very top of them. And it's great to be able to talk to people in those positions. I've recently spoken to an international best-selling author, a lady who is at the absolute top of medical research and doing groundbreaking research in maternal care. I've spoken to a man who rose to the top of the civil service and gave Cobra briefings. I've spoken to a former senior circuit judge at the Old Bailey, a dame of the realm. Today, I'm joined by a man who is a lawyer by trade, but is someone who is at the very top of English sport. I'm delighted to be joined by Ian Metcalfe, Chair of the Commonwealth Games England, or should I say Governor Metcalfe, as you're also a governor of both the Boys and Girls School. Thank you ever so much for your time today, Ian.
Well, that's an absolute pleasure. I'm thinking I must be on the wrong podcast, having heard that introduction. All of those people have done significantly more and better than I have, but it's a joy to be here and very happy to talk about the Commonwealth Games.
So before we do, I've got loads I'd love to ask you about today. But we just before we started recording, we were talking about the year that you left, because you are an old boy of King Edward yourself. You're also an old Edwardian parent with James, who went to the boys' school. You left school in 1977, but actually it was 1976, which is your cohort year.
Yeah, absolutely. I was, to the modern generation, this will sound rather odd, but to any slightly older listeners, they will recognise that if one wanted to stay on and try to get to Oxford or Cambridge, the Oxbridge colleges, universities had their own special entrance exam, and that took place in what was effectively the seventh term, so post A-levels. In my year, believe it or not, 50 out of 100 boys stayed on to take that exam, and then the very great majority of those would typically leave at Christmas. And still in 76, as it were, I was in the very fortunate position of having a very real prospect of playing rugby for England schools, having done reasonably well the previous year, but failed at the final hurdle, but knew that if I played well in the trials, I might have the opportunity to play for England schools in what was then the Five Nations, which took place in April. So I made the decision to stay on to do that, and was very fortunate to be picked and had a wonderful time in what was an English Grand Slam winning team, including beating the Welsh at the National Stadium 26-0, which Mr. Everest enjoyed.
Yeah,
enjoyed, as you can imagine. And then stayed on, having stayed on for two terms, one else down for the last, and played cricket in my final year. And I had also had the privilege of being school captain throughout that year. And the then chief master, a guy called Robson Fisher, was keen that I should stay for the full academic year. So in all of the books, you will see I left in July 1977, whereas in fact, my year, my cohort was 1969 to 1976.
You spoke about England rugby there, but you're also obviously a keen cricketer. Did you spend much time in the classroom when you were at King Edward's, or was it always outside on the sports pitch?
Yeah, that's a good question. My results would show that I didn't spend a huge amount of time in the classroom, and my A, B and C and university degree of a 2-2 was a good sportsman's score draw. Yeah, the school was two things to me. It was an extraordinary education and some wonderful teachers that saw something in me that perhaps I didn't see myself, and encouraged me to work as hard as I could do to gain a university place, any university place, frankly, not just Cambridge. But yeah, sport was a hugely important part of my life. Once I'd got over two shocks, really, as a shell. The first was having come from a football-playing junior school that I could only play football on the parade ground before school or during the lunch breaks. And secondly, that having been placed in Prince Leith, I had to play rugby in a pink rugby shirt. Actually, I've never quite got over that.
Real men wear pink, Ian, I've been told. I've got a number of salmon shirts. I thought they were pink shirts. Yeah. My girlfriend says, no, they are salmon. I've rocked a salmon shirt pink, on a Saturday night.
Yeah, there you go. So I played a lot of school sports, whether that be rugby, cricket, and also, of course, those are the great years of Stuart Birch, a name that, again, some listeners might recognise, who introduced basketball into the school and created a very good basketball team. So I would be training at some form of sport virtually every evening after school, playing basketball on a Friday evening for the school, and then rugby on a Saturday, and all that while living in Castle Bromwich. So it was quite a long slog on the Midland Red into town and then back out on the 61, 2 or 3 down the Bristol Road to get to school every morning and back home again in the evening.
On the one of the very early episodes of this podcast, I spoke to Seb Heaven, as a name you might recognise. He played rugby with your son James. I say he played rugby because I was the captain of the third team at the time that James was in the first team. I did go in and out of the first team, but Seb was by far a more permanent fixture than I was. And he was talking about how he loved it about school, but it really was, you know, in terms, because he did the basketball, he did the rugby, he was athletics, he was a shot putter. And it is, it was almost like you had, you know, your kind of formal education in the daytimes, then every lunchtime and everything you did after school, it was like almost like another day on top of it. Were you always busy then? Did you have much time for yourself, or were you always throwing yourself into team sports?
No, it was always busy. I'm a big fan of team sports, and they've been a fundamental part of our family's life. Yeah, they were very full days. I mean, the alarm would go off at 6:30, 6:45 in Castle Bromwich, and those are the days when you did it on your own. With all due respect to the current generation, nobody put you in a car and drove you to school. We would get the 93 or 94 together with Stephen Frankham and Andrew Hudson, boys from IU. We're both Castle Bromwich infant, Castle Bromwich Junior School, and we'd get into town and we'd walk across town and get the corporation bus out, and then we'd typically actually play ground football before school. And then there'd be something in break or at lunchtime. And then 4 out of 5 evenings, I'd be training from the school day, finished at 4:10, then till about 5:30. And then you would do the reverse journey all the way back home, typically get home about 7:00, which was pretty brutal at this time of year when it was dark. And when you were 11 years old, with a heavy kit bag, and then mum would make some tea and then homework and bed. And repeat for 8 years, but they were great eight years, and they were great fun, and I wouldn't change them to the world, either the education, the friends and friendship, or the sport. Frankly, they were formative years, and the school made my life in so many ways. My dad was a power station engineer, first at Mitchell's Power Station, and then at Hampshire Power Station, and they could never afford to pay school fees for myself or my older brother, who also went to the school. But because we passed the exam, we were paid for by Solihull Local Education Authority, and everything I am today falls back to walking down that drive at 11 years old in 1969. And I am forever grateful for that. And again, one of the reasons why, living 400 yards away from the schools, I still do, I'm on the governing body and try and give back some time and make sure that the boys of the city, obviously we're the governors of the high school as well, but my affinity is obviously much more strongly with the boys' school, that the boys of this city have the same opportunities that I did.
The system's obviously changed now, and you're a big supporter of the Assisted Places scheme. I mean, just to kind of put it into context for my generation, people who listen to this podcast are a bit younger, would you mind just explaining how that worked then? It was very much a case of, if you're clever enough to come to the school, you could pretty much come to, if you passed the exam, you were in. Is that right, or were there a few more stages than that?
No, that was about right. The direct grant system, it was a selective system, and it was an additional exam on top of the 11 plus, the grammar school entry, which, if you're in the right area, could have got you into King Edward's Camp Hill, Five Ways, Handsworth. Actually, because of where we lived, if I passed the 11 plus, I would have gone to Bishop Veazey in Sutton Coldfield, which people that live that side of town would know. But you did a separate exam on top of the 11 plus, sat it separately at separate time. There were two different days or two different Saturday mornings when you took it. And if you passed the exam to a particular level, then you were paid for by your local authority. And then there was a small number of boys who hadn't quite passed the exam to the appropriate level, but they would get a part scholarship. And if their parents could afford it, then they would make up the balance. But they were very much in the minority in the sense they didn't have their full fees paid. Today, as you probably experienced, it's a fee-paying school. It's an independent boys and girls day school, and the parents pay the fees. Now, what's unique about it, unique's a strong word. Obviously, there are many independent fee-paying schools that provide scholarships, but looking at where the school is and the diverse nature of the boys and girls these days, we have a very valuable endowment. which is split between property, real estate, and equities. And this is all publicly available information, is worth somewhere over £100 million in total. And that those monies and the income off those monies has to fund the entire foundation. That's a foundation endowment, not a King Edward School endowment. And that generates an annual income. You wouldn't want to spend the capital endowments, and those monies flow back into the foundation, and a significant proportion of them find their way to fund assisted places at the boys' and girls' schools. But on top of that, over the last 10 years, driven initially by John Claughton, Chief Master sort of two times ago, John came from Eton via Solihull, was, of course, an old boy himself. I had the misfortune of dropping him for the Bromsgrove match, and he's still never forgiven me all those years on. So he appreciated the need for the school to try and become needs blind for the strong academic boys of the Greater Birmingham area, and therefore began the significant fundraising efforts, both in terms of capital fundraising for projects, so the extraordinary donations, support relics given to the school across a range of fronts, particularly, of course, for the Performing Arts Centre. A guy called Andrew Brody has given very significant amounts to the school and funded the new sports centre, which for anybody who lives in the area will know sits just beside the old sports centre down on the Bristol Road, and a range of other old boys, principally, frankly, of the direct grant generation, because they realised they had a free education, they wanted to give something back. A guy called John Osborne funds a significant number of annual scholarships. So the assisted places scheme, where with the support of the sort of people I've mentioned already and a range of others, and a more general appeal and the development office, the school's now able to fund a number of assisted places on top of the assisted places the foundation itself funds, to ensure that boys who would otherwise not be able to afford to come to the school are able to come. A significant proportion of the boys attending the school today have the benefit of some form of contribution to their fees, depending upon the means test and their needs. The assisted places scheme, which raised £10 million under John Claughton's sort of management and drive, is effectively an income-based scheme. So we're spending the income. Of course, that will be exhausted at some point, and therefore the next stage will be an attempt to raise a really significant amount where you can draw down the income off the capital and preserve the capital in much the same way as the foundation endowment operates at the moment.
Bringing it back to you and your experiences of the school, you just mentioned then the tug that you felt, because you've been a huge supporter. You're obviously very passionate about not just raising money today for the assisted places scheme, but raising money for generations to come. Do you ever think about if you hadn't passed that exam and you had gone to Bishop Vesey, would life have been very different for you? You think you're talking about the dedication that you put into sport. You're up at 6:15. You're making your own way in from Castle Brom. You're staying behind. You're doing all this extra stuff. Is that something that's in you? Were you born with that, or did the school help to mould that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Yeah, a bit of both, I suspect, but a bit of both is in a lot of my generation as well. So from a school perspective, Bishop Vesey was and is a brilliant school. And I'd like to think if I'd gone there, that I would have thrived. It would have been a different experience. It was a good school, but it didn't have the academic excellence of King Edwards, and therefore I wouldn't have been rubbing shoulders with the sort of people I was rubbing shoulders with, and they pulled me up. And then, yeah, inevitably you are your genes, and I do think a lot of my generation was the product of the immediate post-war generation. So my father did his national service in India at the time of partition from 46 to 48, didn't actually see active service, and he was a ground engineer in the RAF. My mum was a building society teller from Rugby, and she hid in the shelters as the bombs dropped every night on Coventry, and still talks about that. She's still alive and 88, But they brought with them, and we inherited from them, a great drive. They were from the rationing generation. I didn't really understand, and I guess lots of us don't. Rationing only finished in about 56. They had a long slog. It was hard going. All of our parents were determined to give us the opportunities they didn't have, and they sacrificed whatever they needed to do that. So, of course, whilst my fees were paid, nobody paid for my rugby boots or a cricket bat or that year's version of cricket pads or those sorts of things. There was no support, and that's not a complaint about it, but for those sorts of things. So mum and dad focused. My dad was on the touchline often with mum all of the time, or on the boundary rope or whatever. He was a man that was always there. He was a shift engineer, so he could manage his shift so he could be there. But he was always on the touchline for Mark or for me, and always encouraging us, never criticising us, always giving us lifts to wherever we needed to get to and picking us up later after sports fixtures. And that brings with it a personal drive, which my brother also had, because you want to pay back. I wanted and still want mum. Dad's no longer with us, sadly, but I wanted mum and dad to be proud of me. And I wanted to, as you get older and mature and understand a bit better, wanted them to feel that I had paid back what they'd done for me. And I desperately try and do that for James and for Annie, but also given back to the school and its current masters and chief master and to the city. I'm really proud of Birmingham. Birmingham's given me an awful lot. I'm really proud our children were educated in this city. Our children understand diversity because they live it every day of their lives. They live it every day of their lives at King Edward School. And they respected every faith and every colour and every ethnic background that attended that school, and they are their mates. My son's mates come from a broad range of different ethnic backgrounds, whether they be Vidhi, who's a Sri Lankan, Manish, who's a Muslim. They're just friends, and they've lived with each other. They've come up together. They understand when Manish could only play half of rugby because it was Ramadan. They understand Ramadan. They understand other people's faiths and cultures. They respect them. And they see those people as the friends that they are rather than any issues. And Birmingham's done that for them. So I'm proud of the city as well, as you can probably tell. Birmingham's done me very well. I've never for one moment regretted not going down to London and doing some of the things you can do in a professional services business in London.
In your answer then, you've just covered all the things I wanted to talk to you about for the rest of this conversation. I don't quite know where to start. Just following on from James being friends with Charlie Manish, I remember these guys, I remember those names. Let's come back to Birmingham, because at the moment, just in terms of the kind of news agenda, just before we were talking, I was watching Sky News. And of course, Azeem Rafiq is being interviewed on Sky News at the moment. He's been talking to MPs, the former Yorkshire County Cricket Club player, because discrimination in sport is very much on the news agenda at the moment. You're saying there that going to King Edward School, we were surrounded by all sorts of different cultures. I went to a very white primary school over in Staffordshire, and that was absolutely not the case when I went to Shell D, Mr. Dewar's Shell. Suddenly it did feel like I was in a big multicultural city and one that I'd not really experienced before. And I'm saying this as a white 33-year-old man who went to King Edward School, and I'm hugely privileged. So, you know, I understand that's my viewpoint on this. But I do very much, like you just said, I say to people that I feel like it would be very difficult for me to feel racist feelings because these guys are my friends. Is there, and this is a big question, in terms of discrimination in sport, I suppose my question is this something that's come to a head now and is going to be a big issue that UK sport as a whole, not just cricket, not just Yorkshire, but do we need to look at discrimination within sport? And is this going to rage on for a while? Is there more to look into here? Or is this a very sad situation that one man has faced and is talking to MPs about this week?
Well, the first thing to do with the very sad situation. Yeah, it's absolutely heart-wrenching, and it is extraordinary and shameful. But to answer your other question, Yeah, it is. I can't point to specific examples, and thankfully, when I was playing what was elite amateur rugby in those days at Moseley, I wasn't in a dressing room where that sort of banter took place. We had Afro-Caribbeans playing on that side. They may say different, but I didn't experience that directly. But there is no doubt that the sense of discrimination that the minorities felt was very real. And whether that was direct racist commentary or whether that was careless language, the impact it had on those minorities, as highlighted by the last few days, was extraordinary. It's not great for sport at all. And I think there are a number of us in sport that hope this can be a defining moment when we all put our line in the sand and say, no, one person's banter is another person's discrimination. And I do find it extraordinary to have seen some of the phrases, which I'm not prepared to repeat on this podcast, which were described as banter. They weren't banter to me 50 years ago at school, so they certainly aren't anymore. And we're really proud at Commonwealth Games England that we have a gender equal split on our board, and we have strong ethnic representation with three Afro-Caribbeans on the board, Diane Madal, Denise Lewis and Nigel Walker, and also a Anglo-Lebanese in Ali Jawad, who's a powerlifter. When was it, 12, 16 months ago, when the extraordinary events around the murder, brutal, senseless murder of George Floyd happened on camera, that caused all of us as sports bodies, as private individuals and organisations and the school itself, I'm sure, to look in and think about what we were doing in this territory. And it was really striking for us at Commonwealth Games England to listen to Nigel Walker talk about his experiences of discrimination in his life. And for him to say, don't anybody think this doesn't still go on every day of my life in some small way. And that was really striking. And I think all of us, you talk about your ethnic heritage. I sit here as a 63-year-old white man who's had an extraordinarily privileged life. And I'm very keen to make whatever contribution I can to ensure that the sort of discrimination we've read about and heard about over the last few days, but that's been patently going on for a long time, this just should not happen, must not happen.
Hi, I'm Sanam.
And I'm Bedu, and we've been fundraising in support of the Assisted Places Scheme across each school. What's that, you ask?
The Assisted Places Scheme aims to provide access to excellence for all. So if you want to make a change,
start small and support the campaign. Thank you.
I mentioned there were a few things in your previous answer that I wanted to pick up on. The next one is Birmingham. In terms of Birmingham as a city, why is it that you feel so strongly about Birmingham in terms of you left to go to university, you came back pretty soon after university, is that right?
Yeah.
What drew you back so soon?
The brutally pragmatic answer is the rugby club. I always wanted to come back home and play for Moseley Rugby Club. Moseley was the then equivalent of a premiership rugby club. Had things turned out differently with its financing and various issues, it could be today's Worcester Warriors or Northampton Saints and a professional rugby club attracting crowds of 10 or 15,000. And unfortunately, it didn't turn out that way. But in my day, not because of me, obviously, but because of its history, it was a top 10, top 12 English rugby club. Rugby was a passion to me. It was an amateur sport, so you had to do a job alongside it. But I'd always wanted to come home and play for the local rugby club. And Moseley had a stronger character and personality in those days than any of the London clubs did. The London clubs were Harlequins and they were toffs and had double-barreled names and wore fancy shirts and worked in the city. The sort of working-class London side was Wasps in more in North London. I didn't really have any connections there, although that would probably have been where I went. Rosslyn Park, and then you've got the Exiles clubs, London Welsh, London Irish, London Scottish, that typically drew from those four countries. So there was no pull to go down to London, and I didn't feel the need to go to London from a legal perspective, a profession I gave up, by the way, 7 years ago. I've got a non-exec portfolio of roles now, don't practice as a lawyer anymore. But at that point, I was interested in doing criminal legal aid work as a solicitor advocate. And Birmingham and the West Midlands was as good a place to do that as London, because Victoria Law Courts, Magistrates Courts, it is the largest courts of its type in Western Europe. Because even in London, you split to Marylebone, Horse Ferry Road, different magistrates' courts, whereas the magistrates' courts of Birmingham sit in Victoria Law Courts, so the 32 magistrates' courts that were in my day. So I was coming home to a small legal aid practice, which had two old boys working in it, which is how I made the initial connection when I was 16 years old. And you could do that work just effectively out of Birmingham. I then prosecuted and subsequently changed career to be a corporate lawyer, and the city had four strong firms that did that, and Rag & Co was one of those where I eventually ended up. And there were many more attractions about this city than there were about London, which was the great metropolis, but a very impersonal place of, what is it, I know, 6, 8, 10 million, whereas in those days Birmingham was a much smaller and tighter city. And I still had a lot of friends here, although most of my year group friends did indeed go down to London. And I felt the attractions of Birmingham. And it's a down-to-earth, hard-working, honest, open sort of a place, welcoming, friendly, if you know it. And it's been a fantastic place to bring our children up in and to allow them to understand a much broader perspective on the world because of the people they have rubbed shoulders with, the schools they've been to. Both James and Annie went to Station Road Junior School in Harborne, one of the great state junior schools, as it were, with a very rich ethnic heritage. And then likewise on to King Edward's and Edgbaston High, which again had a broad range of ethnic backgrounds as their pupils, and therefore both James and Annie have great friends from ethnic minorities and understand their differences and their similarities and their friendships. And Birmingham's done that for them in a way I'm not sure some of the other great regional cities of the country would have done, or indeed London, where London, as I increasingly understand with our children living down there, is in fact a collection of villages rather than one big city. So I don't have a moment's regret. My wife was actually born in Sutton Coldfield and then moved up to Leeds, educated up in Leeds, and we met at university and she got a job at Edgbaston High School, and we've been here since I came back from law school in 1981.
Speaking about Birmingham, and it's kind of, it feels like Birmingham stock is rising all of the time. I live in Liverpool now. I moved up here for a job. I started my career producing a breakfast show, radio breakfast show in Birmingham, Capital FM Birmingham. Moved up here to run Capital Liverpool as a managing editor. Just talking about the kind of northern cities, you know, in terms of big corporations, big organisations moving out of London. Channel 4 have just secured premises in Leeds. The BBC are moving, and this is in my industry, of course, the BBC are moving, and now Radio 1, a lot of the schedule, for example, is coming from Manchester and Media City. Liverpool's stock, I mean, I live here, so I'm biased, and I love it here, and I want to stay forever, but it seems to be rising all the time too. Birmingham was always the second city. Do you feel like, is Birmingham having to fight for its place a little bit more these days in terms of that kind of second city status? I am moving here towards talking to about the games and the impact that will have on the city next year. But what do you think, just in general terms?
I think it's always had to fight for its place. And it hasn't done it very well in large parts of its history. There were the great days under Albert Bohr, 20-odd years ago, when the whole NEC precinct was developed and the whole area around the ICC was developed. And then a relatively poor period until the recent and not so recent past, I guess, over the influence of Ian Ward, the leader of Birmingham City Council, very strong together with Andy Street. And of course, that cross-party sense of a Tory elected mayor in a region where five of the seven local authorities are Labour controlled. Birmingham has not fought its corner that well. Manchester's been, and indeed Liverpool, have been much louder. As an amateur psychologist, I'd say the football's had something to do with it, although I'm not a football person. Birmingham's football clubs have not been successful generally. Villa obviously enjoying moderate success and greater success than Birmingham. Where if you look at Liverpool, you have Liverpool and Everton, you have Manchester City, Manchester United. And the cities have felt good about themselves because they've had great football teams, and the average working man in those cities on a Saturday afternoon supports their football team, and the football team wins and everybody feels good about themselves. In this city, the Blues, the Villa, the Baggies, Wolves, nobody stood out. And that has meant that the average working man, and indeed lady, of course, supporting football, goes to work on a Monday morning pretty miserable, pretty down. We've lost again this weekend. And that's developed that sort of dry, self-deprecating, Brummy, black country wit, where we always downplay our successes and we always downplay the areas in which we live. And you get in a degree of a downward spiral. We become the car park off the M6. I think that worm's turned. We are on a strong upward trajectory and we realise how good what we've got is, whether that be the physical infrastructure, which continues to improve, or the will of the people. I know Liverpoolians would say this about each other, but Brummies will do anything for anyone, as long as you ask them nicely and as long as they feel they're not being taken advantage of. And they will and are driving this city forward. And the games will help, but James got married in Birmingham. His wife actually living in Winchester, but from an army, Salisbury, actually from an army background. They'd lived in 13 different places. So they asked to marry in our parish church, which is Edgbaston Old Church. And they all came up to Birmingham and they couldn't get their breath.
Yeah,
married in the old church, walked across the golf club, looked out from the golf club at all the trees. Some of them spent time in the centre of Birmingham. Some of them stayed in the nice hotels around Edgbaston these days, had dinner at the Highfield or whatever. They could not get their breath. And then other guests that came up for the weddings, blimey, I didn't realise how wonderful Birmingham was these days. Look how it's changed. Isn't it wonderful? I've only ever driven past it on the M6. Well, actually, I've only ever sat in a traffic jam beside it on the M6. And when you get them into the city and around the city and meeting the people, I realise what an extraordinary area of the country it is. We're on the way back. I mean, one of the great stories about the games is the two principal infrastructure builds, the new aquatic centre at Samwell and the refurbishment of Alexander Stadium in Perry Bar. People forget that the Olympics was already ready. The only reason the Olympics didn't take place in 2020 is because it wasn't safe for the athletes to travel there. All their infrastructure was finished. Not a single spade had been put in the ground at Sandwell, and Perry Bar, the demolition had just about finished, but the build hadn't started the day lockdown started. And the next day, all of the subbies, typical Brummy guys or Black Country guys, came together with the principal contractor and said, how are we going to make this work? We have to keep going. We have to do this collectively. How can we make it work? And they worked out a plan. And they created more walkways through the sites. They created one-way systems. They built more scaffolding ladders. They agreed to daily lateral flow testing. And both of those projects, 19 months later, are on time and on budget. And there's no reason why they shouldn't continue to be so. They're both weatherproof effectively now, and therefore a bad winter shouldn't set them back too materially either. That's a great example of the Brummy and Black Country spirit. We get things done. We don't shout about it. We don't grandstand about it. We don't want to be on the front page of newspapers about it. We just go out and get it done. And that's the wonderful thing about the Brummies and about this city, which continues to regenerate in so many ways.
Speaking about the impact then of an event like the 2022 Games and what that has on the city, obviously, you know, there's the obvious things that come to mind. Infrastructure, there's going to be facilities there that we can use now for years to come. Local economy benefits for bringing visitors in for the duration of the Games and the impact that has on the local economy. What other impacts do you think it has? What you were saying about, unfortunately, Aston Villa not performing particularly well recently, we can skim over that quite quickly, although Steven Gerrard is now here and hopefully taking us to the top. But is there an emotional impact as well as the infrastructure and the kind of economic, obvious, tangible benefits? Is there an emotional benefit for a city to hold a Games like this?
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, there's a range of legacy benefits, obviously, but I mean, the first, very practical, the anticipated audience for the opening ceremony is 2 billion people. One third of the world should be watching the opening ceremony.
Wow.
So, yeah, that's quite a large number. They'll be watching Birmingham. And the opening ceremony will be exceptional. The creative team led by a guy called Martin Green were the London 2012 team. And indeed, Martin since then has been chief executive of European City of Culture at Hull. Just a fantastic creative guy with a brilliant team behind him. And that event of itself has the capacity to put Birmingham comprehensively on a global stage in a way that it never has been before. I've had the privilege of seeing some of the initial concepts and thinking around the opening ceremony. It's Birmingham. It's Birmingham and the West Midlands. Obviously, it'll be England and the United Kingdom, and fingers crossed the Queen is fit enough and well enough to be there herself. But you will come away from that ceremony with a great understanding of the contribution this city has made over the last 200 years, frankly. Indeed, the contribution the school has made to that, with some of the characters which were at this school that have made a big contribution to the city, and a much better understanding of our place on a world stage. So that's a pretty good start, seems to me. Fingers crossed the sun's shining and it's not where. I mean, that won't impact the ceremony or the TV. Of course, these are TV extravaganzas these days, but there'll be obviously 32,000 in the stadium. So that's the first part. And the evidence from London was that if you're a sports geek, your memory is of Super Saturday. You remember Jess Ennis-Hill winning the heptathlon, you remember Greg Rutherford winning the long jump, and you remember that extraordinary evening of Mo Farah winning the 10,000 three gold medals in a day, which really fired those Olympic Games. But if sport's not really your thing, you remember London 2012 opening ceremony. Everybody remembers that opening ceremony. You remember Mr. Bean with his umbrella dinking the thing on the Chariots of Farm. You remember the NHS beds. You remember
Bond.
Bond coming out of the helicopter. You remember the extraordinary Olympic torch they created and the way in which it came down and was lit. The world remembers those things, and we as a country remembers those things. Birmingham 2022 will do the same for you. And as you say, in terms of an emotional legacy, perhaps for the first time in our lives, we'll feel proud about ourselves. We did this. Birmingham did this. Birmingham people did this. And obviously the creative team comes from all over, but some of them have very strong connections, and Martin himself is deliberately recruited within Birmingham. But there'll be Birmingham people out there on the stage. There'll be Birmingham dancers and Birmingham volunteers and West Midlands people. So I think there's a huge opportunity for the city to feel proud about itself. And then, of course, as you say, there's the broader legacy. We're recruiting 13,000 volunteers and training them. And many of those will be from the local area. And that will provide a legacy to the area for future sporting events, future major events. There's a Jobs and Skills Academy. We're training young people as well to take up the job availabilities. the games themselves is offering jobs. And then both government agencies and sporting agencies are investing significantly in the area to ensure the legacy is maximised. Even this morning, I read the piece, Sport England are putting about 6 million into physical activity in the area post-games. So there's a broad range of much deeper legacies than just the physical infrastructure. The legacy plan stretches to 30 pages. And if you remind me of your email after this podcast, I'll send you an extraordinary poem by Casey Bailey, who's a school teacher in Nichols and also the Birmingham Poet Laureate, called Dive In, which is set to various sporting clips as well and clips of Birmingham. And that 3.5 minutes sums up Birmingham and the Brummies, and will, I hope, get much broader coverage than it's got today. The games themselves will comprise 4,500 athletes, 6,500 in total, with officials and coaches and all of the sports staff that goes with that. The second largest event on a sporting stage anywhere in the world after the Olympics. Those people will come from those six continents from all over the world to be here. It'll be the largest event of its type ever to take place in the West Midlands and the largest event to take place in this country since the London 2012 Olympics. You will, I'm sure, know that the range of different sports, over 19 sports, it's also unique in sporting events that the para sports are integrated with the main game. So you don't have a main Commonwealth Games and a para Commonwealth Games afterwards. So athletics, swimming, triathlon, para powerlifting, wheelchair basketball, para table tennis, para lawn bowls. I'll have missed one inevitably, but a range of para sports, and they're simply integrated within the normal timetable. So if you go, if you're fortunate enough to get tickets to the games, and 67% of tickets so far sold out, 30% ahead of expectation at this point, you will see para sports. They will be in front of a full crowd, no sense of a sort of half-empty stadium, and they have the opportunity to perform in front of those crowds at the same time as their able-bodied compatriots, as it were. So gender equal, more medals for women than for men for the first time ever with the introduction of T20 cricket, just balanced the scales in favour of women. A Super Sunday when women's hockey, women's netball and women's T20 finals will follow on from each other through the course of the day, and a huge opportunity for women's sport. So, just getting a better and broader feel for what the Games represents and the opportunity for tourism during the Games, the visitors, and as we've already talked about, the global stage, global TV stage, the Games will be found on. And, of course, it's not just Commonwealth countries that watch the Games. They'll be watched by people from all over the world. They'll be watching elite sport coming from our city and the region.
Ian, I'd like to say thank you ever so much for your time. I've taken up lots of it and it's been wonderful to... I mean, we've talked a lot about your school, your city, your role. I hope you don't mind that we haven't spoken much about you, but I think the fact that we've spoken about all these other things probably tells me quite a lot about you. I would like to ask you one final question, and I ask this to everybody who comes on the podcast. Not in terms of a certificate or a qualification or a mentor or... just in terms of a characteristic, what characteristic would you say has served you best?
Wow. Gritty determination.
I had a feeling you might work, say that.
Hard work. And yet always doing what I said I was going to do and delivering on that. What I have was imbued at school. And it was all about hard work. I'm not the brightest button in the box. And people like Derek Everest and David Buttress and others at the school, Harry Dealman in economics, you can achieve a hell of a lot if you set your mind to it And if you relentlessly work hard with determination and honesty and and sheer hard work, frankly. So I guess that would be one characteristic. And an empathy and humanity and caring for people. My brother died young, sadly, at 49. And one of the things I said at his funeral was, he was a man who always did what he said he was going to do. And unusually, unbelievably, there aren't that many people that do that. So that would be it, I guess.
Ian Metcalf, thank you ever so much for your time on Ed Talks today. It's been an absolute pleasure to meet you.
Right. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to Ed Talks. I hope that you've enjoyed today's conversation. If you have, it would be great if you could subscribe to this podcast on whatever app you're listening on, so you can keep up to date with future episodes. And if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, then we'd really appreciate it if you could leave your feedback in the review section. If you're listening on a platform where you can't leave your comments, then please do email me with your feedback. My email address is ben@soundrebel.co.uk. If you would like to feature on this podcast as a guest, then please email Adelaide Bailey at the Development Office. Her email address is aab@kes.beham.sch.uk. That's aab@kes.beham.sch.uk. She's also the person to email with any news that you think should be featuring in Old Ed's publications, either in print or online. Finally, if you think a podcast would enhance the communications of your business, organisation or charity, then I'd love to talk to you about producing it. My email address again is ben@soundrebel.co.uk. Thank you again for listening, and I hope you'll join me again.